The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first 3 meals free.
Hi, this is The Takeaway for Monday, October 10th, 2016.
Well, here we go again.
It's like a national catastrophe.
Okay, Donald, I know you're into big diversion tonight. Anything to avoid talking about your campaign and the way it's exploding.
She lied. Now she's blaming the lie on the late, great Abraham Lincoln.
He has also targeted immigrants, African Americans, Latinos, people with disabilities, POWs, Muslims, and so many others.
She has made bad judgment not only on taxes, she's made bad judgments on Libya, on Syria, on Iraq. Disaster.
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 You know it. We all know it.
If this were just about one video, maybe what he's saying tonight would be understandable. But everyone can draw their own conclusions at this point.
No, I'm a gentleman, Hillary. Go ahead.
We deserve answers.
She talks about words that I said 11 years ago.
Donald talking about women.
I think it's disgraceful.
What he thinks about women.
And I think she should be ashamed of herself if you want to know the truth.
What he does to women.
Bill Clinton. Far worse.
I'm sorry I have to keep saying this, but he lives in an alternative reality.
But when you talk about apology, and the thing that you should be apologizing for are the 33,000 emails that you deleted and that you acid washed.
It's just awfully good that someone with the temperament of Donald Trump is not in charge of the law in our country.
Because you'd be in jail.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick in for John Hockenberry today. Thank you so much for listening. 28 days until Election Day, but in the last 72 hours, the campaign for president has, it can be said, gone off the rails. Donald Trump suggesting sexual assault on a hot mic, Republican officials abandoning him, unendorsing, some calling on him to exit the race, even questions about whether his own running mate will stay on the ticket. Now, Donald Trump took another unprecedented step last night. He threatened, if elected, to put his political opponent in prison. It's the kind of thing you're used to hearing maybe from a banana republic dictatorship, but it was yet another aspect of the Trump phenomenon that's upended political traditions in the United States and now caused some Republicans to head for the exits. In a moment, one woman who's as strongly behind Donald Trump as ever. But last night was what many Republicans described as the last chance for Donald Trump to redeem some part of his campaign, either for the presidency or at least to prevent down-ticket Republicans from suffering in November. And for some, that last chance was already gone before the cameras came on in prime time. Kim Alfano is a Republican strategist and CEO of Alfano Communications. She says Trump's first debate performance and the release of those Access Hollywood tapes last Friday confirmed for her that Donald Trump shouldn't be president.
I've decided that I can't be with him. And it happened prior to the debate. It actually happened from the last debate. But I can't be with Hillary either. So I'm in the age-old conundrum of every other person out there that's just looking at this thing and sort of got a pit in their stomach.
So this was not a function of the latest video of Friday where Donald Trump is talking about women and how he moves on them and everybody knows what's in that video. It's not because of that?
Yeah, well, it's partially because of that, but I have to say that I think the last debate performance, there's a couple of things for me. One, I think character does matter, but I think both of these candidates are just fatally flawed when it comes to character. But I think Donald Trump showed in the last debate that he's imminently baitable. I mean, he just can't seem to not run his campaign or his actions on anything but his personal ego, and that to me seems dangerous.
You know, Kim, I hear what you're saying, and there are lots and lots of Republicans over the weekend who bolted from Donald Trump, unendorsed or said they couldn't support him or actively said that they would vote for Hillary Clinton now because of that video on Friday from the Hollywood bus. And I know you were sort of there a little bit before that, but a lot of the reaction has been, as bad as that video was, or even the debate performance, none of it was really new. There were other Republicans and other conservatives warning about Donald Trump for a year, not just sexism and that approach to women, but also impulsivity, inability to edit himself. None of it was new.
Right. No, I agree. I can't say I was ever really there. I think for the sake of the party, you try to come up with some rationale and some outcome that's better than having Hillary Clinton be president. That debate, that last debate, when he was taking the bait and acting like a petulant child, which he has throughout, his bombast turned to, I think, unsteady behavior. It scares me. It scares me him sitting somewhere negotiating something that could put myself in jeopardy and my child. I just don't see his ability to be disciplined enough to not be personal about it. I'm a single mom of an 11-year-old daughter. You cap it with this video where that doesn't just put the public discourse in jeopardy. It puts her, the whole mentality of the country, and it puts her in jeopardy. Then it just kind of was a tipping point, I guess.
Kim Alfano is a Republican strategist. She's CEO of Alfano Communications in Delaware. Kim Alfano, thanks a lot.
Thanks.
So Kim Alfano is one Republican woman who says she's had enough. She's off of the Trump train. But not all Republicans are ready to bolt. Far from it. Lee Snover is a Republican from Pennsylvania. She was a delegate for Donald Trump at the GOP convention in Cleveland, and she remains a strong Trump backer from the battleground state of Pennsylvania.
Well, I think the second debate, he did good enough to put away the, that false morality going on with the tape. I think he did a good job of putting that away because the debate performance was so much better and they talked about the issues. I don't think that's going to be the highlight this week. Yes, he had a tough week, but I think he came out. He was much more practiced. He was prepared. It looked like his campaign had, worked with him and Kellyanne Conway had sat down with him and prepared him for this debate. And debate number two, he did a great job as far as I'm concerned.
Now, you said false morality. Talk to me about that a little bit. You were talking about the video and the audio from Access Hollywood and his comments about how he moved on a married woman and what people have seen as fantasizing about sexual assault or acknowledging it. You call that false morality.
Well, what I'm saying here is I listened to it and, yeah, I was disappointed and disgusted. And I was like, oh, I can't believe he said that. But it was 11 years ago. But here's what I'm talking about. And this is what I really want to get through to the American people. I think this morality outrage is fake. I think it's coming from the Democrat Hillary Clinton, but it's also coming from the Republican establishment and the Bushes. I think it's fake. And here's why I say that. We have told the religious right over and over, stop talking about character, stop talking about morality, do not judge me. And now we're talking about it again. And I just think that it's fake. I think that we live in a secular America. We don't look at presidents that way. We look at what they're going to do with policy. We don't look at their character anymore. We've said that before, that they have a private life. Bill Clinton said that. I have a private life. And let's go back to 1992, just for a flashback. What did they say in his campaign? They wanted to take the focus off his infidelity. They said it's the economy, stupid. Why aren't we saying that now? I mean, I say it's the job, stupid. It's manufacturing, stupid. It's security.
But then it seems to me, if that's true, Lee Snover, and that's certainly your view on the Trump candidacy in all-important Pennsylvania, that there's an awful cognitive dissonance built into the Trump phenomenon then. A person who's about jobs, returning jobs, manufacturing, all these things you care about, who wants the evangelicals and the Christian voters and the religious right, the Mike Pence people, if you will, to be on board. This is a very, very complicated, fraught, and sort of dysfunctional relationship then.
I would agree that it's a little bit dysfunctional, but the evangelicals, they are not looking for a pastor or preacher or pope anymore. They understand that America's moving in the wrong direction, and they want to change it. And they know that's with Donald Trump. They're not going to get any change with Hillary, and they know that. They're not looking at Donald Trump and saying, he shares my morality. Donald Trump does not share my morality. But I do think Donald Trump is pro-life, and I do think they believe that. And they think that's a character issue in his favor. But I don't think they're looking for that. I think they're looking at, he's already given out the names of who he's going to appoint to the Supreme Court, and they're very interested in that. And that's a big concern of theirs. They want to protect the Second Amendment. So there's different reasons they support Donald Trump, but it's not his morality. They're not weighing it next to their morality.
All right, Lee, you and I are both from Pennsylvania. This is Donald Trump's critical state. If he can't win Pennsylvania, there's almost no way to become president. The polls aren't all the same, but it's looking, frankly, pretty bad right now for him, between 9 and 12 points behind Hillary with only 30 days to go. You're going to the rallies. You're talking to the activists. What has to happen here in Pennsylvania for him?
Listen, we have 30 days. Anything can happen. We could turn this election around. He can still win. I mean, one thing I'll tell you about the Trump voters, they are amped. They are energized. I mean, Hurricane Matthew can be on election day and they are voting. They're coming to the polls. They're dragging their friends to the polls. I think that the Donald Trump voters are going to be so energized, and they are energized against Hillary Clinton, but they're energized against the establishment, and they're coming out to vote more so than ever. They're amped.
So you've said there's this wave of pro-Trump enthusiasm in Pennsylvania and in other places, and that even if Donald Trump doesn't win this election, that there's an important message that you want to send to Republicans, too, not just Democrats.
Yeah, there's an important message. I think that I'm concerned about the Republican Party, and it's because the establishment did not get on board with him like they should have. And, you know, I'm against dynasty. I'm against the Bushes. I'm against the Clintons. I want a new Republican Party. I want a Republican Party that recruits candidates that are outside the establishment. And I think the establishment's going to pay for this. I mean, I really do. I think there's going to be backlash on them for years. I think it's going to take a long time for the establishment to get the conservative, independent, and the populist Republicans back on board.
So Donald Trump can win. Tell me how. Give me a little strategy. What can he do? Enthusiasm's not enough. He's way down.
It's not enough, but you know what it is? He needs to talk about the issues. Those weeks when he was on Policy Message, the polls were so tight. When he is on teleprompter and he is on Message and he's explaining his plan.
Yeah, but he can't. That's the whole point, Lee, is that he's shown that he can't stay on Message, that he can't stay on prompter.
But he can stay on Message.
He
yes, he can. He's got 30 days to do it, you know? I mean, they say if you can do anything for 28 days, you can do it the rest of your life. Let's get him to do it for 28 days, and then he can do it for 8 years of his presidency.
That's Lee Snover. She's from Easton, Pennsylvania, pro-Trump delegate from the Republican National Convention. And my guest, Lee, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome back. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. With less than 30 days before the election, that damning video surfaced before the weekend, of course, that shook the Trump campaign. It reveals a 59-year-old Donald Trump, 11 years ago, bragging about forcing himself on women and grabbing their genitals in what amounted to a thinly veiled description of sexual assault, more or less. In a video apology and in last night's debate, Donald Trump chalked it up to locker room banter. But the political fallout that ensued was quick and harsh. Top Republican leaders, including John McCain, Condoleezza Rice, and others, withdrew their support for Donald Trump. Even Donald Trump's own running mate, Mike Pence, condemned his remarks. And now a series of Republican senators and representatives, governors, have stepped forward, calling for Donald Trump to step down from the Republican ticket. Donald Trump said over the weekend and implied strongly in the debate last night that he's never withdrawn in his entire life and that he's not stepping aside now. So with me to discuss the state of the GOP ticket from the race for the White House on down to Republicans' bid to hold on to control in the Senate is Caitlin Huey Byrne. She's national political reporter for Real Clear Politics. Caitlin, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
It's great to have you. You know, for so many Republicans over the weekend who bolted the Trump train unendorsed or said they're not going to vote for him, it was sort of the final straw. And why now? Why is now the final straw when there's been so much over the campaign that could have been a lot of straws?
I think that was the question of the weekend. Republicans have had really over a year full of off-ramps, so to speak, to bolt from this Republican nominee, now Republican nominee. There was, remember, discussion before the convention about whether there would be a revolt against him, and establishment figures in the RNC really tried to tamp that down. There were plenty of opportunities, but I think the reasons why this was really the straw that broke the camel's back was it was because it was on tape, because of the vulgarity of the comments, and also because voters are already weighing in at this point. Remember, early voting already started. There was this sense of urgency in some ways among Republicans to get out in front of this. And it was just in my conversations with strategists and such, it just seemed like this was an issue that they could not defend.
But then you look back to you know, five different times on Capitol Hill where Paul Ryan has had to come to the microphone to rebuke the nominee, to call he's had to call him racist. Mm-hmm. He's had to call him xenophobic in a way. So none of this was new. And to me, you know, Caitlin, it seems like this was bad and on tape, but it was also a month before the election, and these politicians now know that he can't win, and that's the real off-ramp. He can't win, and so now I'm going to back away and try to salvage something for myself.
Exactly. That's such an important point, because when you looked at the polling heading into this weekend before this tape was released, Donald Trump was behind nationally and in key battleground states like New Hampshire, for example, Colorado, Pennsylvania, you name it. And these are all states, of course, North Carolina as well. These are all states, of course, where Republican incumbents are trying to hold their seats. And so this was, I think you're exactly right, a moment in which they realized that Trump was behind anyway, and that, remember, heading into this, Republican incumbents were kind of walking this fine line of not completely distancing themselves from Trump because they wanted to appeal to his voters in some way. They didn't want to lose that support. Now the calculation, of course, that Trump is so poisonous to them that any benefit they would get from those voters, they kind of don't even want to go there.
The other side of this that everyone's forgetting to talk about because this is so white hot is that this could have been a weekend that was very difficult for Hillary Clinton. Another round of emails hacked from her campaign showing ostensibly that she does one thing in public and another thing in private. Maybe a lot of politicians do that, but this would have been a very tough week for her but for Donald Trump.
Exactly. And why that could have been so damaging for her is because look at what her biggest vulnerability was and has been throughout this entire cycle: trustworthiness and honesty. Trump has been running as kind of the change agent against someone who he has framed as a creature of Washington who won't do anything differently. And those comments released by WikiLeaks go to exactly to that point. But Donald Trump couldn't even address that over the weekend. He did in the debate when prompted because he was battling these issues of his own. This is an example of time and time again, Donald Trump cannot get out from under himself, right? Last week, the issue of Obamacare could have been front and center, especially given Bill Clinton's comments about it. Donald Trump was instead trying to clean up messes that he created regarding things that were brought up in the first debate.
Let's talk about the Senate, because some senators, Republican senators, who were trying to keep their grip on the Senate, it's tenuous, have managed to run well in front of Donald Trump. Rob Portman is the Republican incumbent from Ohio, running way in front of Donald Trump there. Portman's probably going to hang on to his seat even if Trump loses in Ohio. But what about these other critical Senate states like New Hampshire, like Pennsylvania, Wisconsin? Do we have a sense now of the weight of the drag, if any, on these Republicans who are trying to hang on?
Well, I think we had a sense of Donald Trump's drag before all of this. He is behind in New Hampshire. He's behind in Pennsylvania, where Pat Toomey is running for reelection. These candidates have tried to distance themselves in ways and have tried to run ahead of Donald Trump in ways. And in many ways, they have actually been successful in doing that. When you look at the polling, these Republican incumbents are typically running ahead of Donald Trump, but not always enough to beat their Democratic challenger. I think that Donald Trump already had a weight on these particular states already heading into this past weekend. And I think, you know, he figures to do further damage. Donald Trump has made it very difficult for some of these Republican incumbents to reach out in ways that they need to among independent voters, among suburban women, for example. Rob Portman is a really good example of someone who's been able to run really his own campaign. But he also benefits in some ways from favorable demographics to Donald Trump in a state like Ohio, where it's predominantly white, where Donald Trump's trade message really plays in. And so there are some kind of built-in advantages. In a place like New Hampshire or Pennsylvania, even North Carolina now is a really key battleground. It's a harder line for these Republicans to toe. So they have tried to distance themselves from Trump now, saying he should get off the ticket. Although in North Carolina, Senator Burr has not done so yet. He was waiting to see what the debate brought. But I don't think that Donald Trump gave them any more reason in this past debate that he would be any different.
Caitlin Huey Burns is national political reporter for Real Clear Politics. Thanks for coming in and talking to us.
Thank you.
It's called extreme vetting.
We will have vetting that is as tough as it needs to be.
These are radical Islamic terrorists, and she won't even mention the word.
We need American Muslims to be part of our eyes and ears on our front lines.
Obamacare is a disaster.
Right now, we are at 90% health insurance coverage. That's the highest we've ever been in our country. The Russians hack information. We don't even know if it's accurate information.
I know nothing about Russia. I know about Russia.
His plan will give the wealthy and corporations the biggest tax cuts they've ever had.
She complains that Donald Trump took advantage of the tax cut. Well, why didn't she change it? Why didn't you change it when you were a senator?
This is the 10th or 12th time that he's denied being for the war in Iraq, and you can see it.
I was against the war in Iraq. It has not been debunked. And you voted for it, and you shouldn't have.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. The first two questions of last night's presidential town hall dealt with what voters in the campaigns have been talking about all weekend long: Donald Trump's lewd behavior toward women and bragging about sexual assault. Trump's performance in the debate last night may have bolstered those Republicans who are staying with him, but the true effect on the broader race maybe can't be known yet. In a political morning consult poll right after Donald Trump's comments on Friday, 74% of Republicans said they still wanted the party to stand behind the Republican nominee. There's little chance of Donald Trump leaving the ticket now, but then the question is, how much support does he have in the broader electorate? Michael Ramlett is co-founder and CEO of Morning Consult. Michael, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Todd. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's still too early for the kind of public polling that takes into account debates and the several days after major campaign events like those Access Hollywood tapes. So what do we actually know now?
What we know right now is that in the first 24 hours, it was a more limited impact than what you might have found if you tuned into cable news or kind of the broader elite discussion on the issue. I think we've seen this time and again on issues like the POW statements and John McCain, Mexican and Muslim Americans, that despite what would typically drown a candidate in more historical settings, it's just not the case in this dynamic between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump.
So we've seen some data that Republicans, Trump supporters, aren't bolting from the campaign. But the important thing now really are uncommitted voters, right? Many of them GOP moderates or independents, a lot of them women. They were starting to break for Hillary Clinton before Friday's tapes were released, right? So that seems like the most important metric. Maybe we don't know that yet.
Yes and no. I think if you look at the overarching strategy, the Trump campaign hasn't necessarily focused as much on swing voters as you've seen some prior presidential candidates on the Republican side. He's very much focused in his campaign on bringing out the base. And what you saw last night was a very base-focused line of attack. And I think more than anything, they look and see there's a certain degree of white non-registered voters that could turn out at a higher level than they have historically, or that's been the overarching strategy proposition. There is this overarching concern that among certainly moderate and center-right candidates, especially down ticket, that without a stronger outreach to more swing voters, that it's more of a challenge in states like in North Carolina or in Pennsylvania.
So Donald Trump is still hoping to generate so much enthusiasm among primarily white voters, whites without a college degree, among the base that he's developed to swamp any of these other efforts. But he's trailing in Pennsylvania, New Hampshire, North Carolina, other places. Is there an indication that he may be running out of oxygen, or in those places can a massive base swell for Donald Trump overcome that?
I think it's important to know that the polling has shifted back and forth. You saw Clinton extend her lead after the conventions. That then shrunk down to a much closer race. You saw Clinton again extend her lead after the first presidential debate. And actually, most polls following the vice presidential debate sort of showed the race starting to tighten again. And now you saw the beginning of potentially an expansion following this video. We saw her have a 2-point change in the overall state of the race. I think it's just important to know that these are so well-defined candidates that it's unlikely that you're going to see huge shifts one direction or another. I think the most important piece in terms of kind of the overarching state of the race is really on the down ticket, where I think a lot of especially GOP candidates at the Senate and congressional level are sort of in a catch-22, because like you mentioned before, you know, 74% of the GOP says that the leader should stand by Trump, and 39% of Republican voters say they're less likely to support a candidate who abandons him. So if you look at it in that context, I think the overarching fluidness race is going to play out when we look at control of the Senate and control of the House. I think no matter what, the presidential race is going to stay rather tight.
And that helps explain why more and more Republicans have said they're finally out. They have to worry about their own races. Michael Ramlett, co-founder and CEO of Morning Consult, thanks so much.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free plus free shipping by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
The death toll in the wake of Hurricane Matthew in Haiti has risen to an estimated 1,000 people, and the country is now in a national state of mourning. Tens of thousands of homes have been destroyed, and humanitarian workers say the need for humanitarian assistance is urgent. In addition to property loss, crops have been destroyed, compounding food shortages and renewed fears of cholera. With lingering frustrations of how outside aid was distributed after the earthquake 10 years ago, Haitians are taking some recovery matters into their own hands now. MJ Fiev is a Haitian-born writer and educator and author of A Sky, The Color of Chaos, a memoir. She's been in touch with friends and family in Haiti who were affected by this hurricane.
Well, we do have some hope now because at first communication was very, very difficult. We had tens of thousands of people stranded because there was no way to get in touch with the small towns and the fishing villages in the south section of the country. It wasn't until Thursday that communication was reestablished. And by Friday, helicopters were starting to reach areas that were in dire need of help.
Now, so much of this, though, happens, of course, in the backdrop of the earthquake. And I wonder how Haitians that you're talking to and that you're hearing about feel about the way aid is being distributed, if they have a lot of trust in the system right now?
Well, a lot of people are afraid that it's going to be a repeat of the post-earthquake situation. Back in 2010, there was no government control as far as aid was involved. International aid organizations were helping, yes, but it was difficult to see exactly what was being done. And in the end, there were no tangible results. So people are afraid that a lot of organizations are going to say that they're helping, but in fact, the population is not really seeing the help. So although now we only have an interim government because the elections were supposed to take place on Sunday, October 9th, and of course that didn't happen because of the hurricane, the interim president did say that they would make sure that they can control what's going on in terms of aid. Of course, this is a very tricky situation because very soon they will have to hold the elections, so we will have new people with new ideas. And for international aid organizations, striking a balance between working with the government and delivering life-saving assistance very fast is not always easy.
Is there a lingering effect, MJ Fev, of the scandal that arose from the cholera outbreak in the last disaster? Of course, it was eventually evident that UN troops had helped to spread cholera unintentionally, that they were the source of the outbreak. There was a lot of distrust after that of international organizations, including the UN. Is that still affecting the attitude that people have toward aid and aid workers?
Yes, absolutely. 9,000 people died in 5 years of cholera, and there were hundreds of thousands more infected. And although the UN did finally apologize for the disease, there was no responsibility for reparations. So people are very reluctant in terms of trusting foreign organizations. And now, all the efforts that were made to combat cholera, you know, all those structures have been destroyed by the hurricane. So we've had many cases of tainted water supplies. On Saturday, people were reporting a lot of deaths related to cholera, 6 in a place called Randall, 7 in Anse-des-Noz, 17 in Chaudronnière, and they were reporting at least 62 people infected.
So that's to say cholera is now a returning problem after the hurricane. Yes. It's still lingering.
Yes, exactly. It's still there, and it's a very unfortunate reminder of all the mistakes that were made after the earthquake.
MJ Fiev is a Haitian-born writer and educator, author of A Sky, The Color of Chaos, a memoir. MJ Fiev, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Before the arrival of Europeans to North America, there may have been more than 250 Native American languages spoken, with within 14 language families, more than in all of Europe combined. Today, 50 languages are extinct. Only 5 families of languages, and many of them have only a handful of speakers. It was app developer Derek Baxter's daughter who had questions about her Ojibwe identity that prompted him to think about ways to make language more accessible. Derek Baxter, through his company called Agoki Learning Systems, Derek Baxter developed an app complete with pronunciation of Ojibwe words, phrases, and maps of Ojibwe territory. It's one of a growing group of tools for Indigenous peoples to hold on to their language and culture. And Derek Baxter joins me from Winnipeg in Manitoba now. Hi, Derek.
Hi, Todd. How are you?
Great to have you. Why is it important for your daughter to learn Ojibwe? What did she say to you?
Well, she actually asked me, what tribe are we from? And she was struggling with her own identity in school. I know that sounds like such a weird thing when you're a Canadian or an American, but it was tough for me because it felt like I had failed her. So I just let her know where she's from, who she is, and our background.
What was the first thing she learned or wanted to learn how to say?
She wanted to learn really how to say hello and the basics, how are you, that type of thing. So I ended up purchasing a few books and some CDs, some audio CDs, and they just never got open. It wasn't until I started to make an app for her, and I didn't know how to make an app. I just figured she uses this iPad all the time. I might as well put together something, and she started using it right away.
So it's not that there aren't resources available for kids or anybody else to learn Ojibwe words, phrases, or even facts about the culture or the territory. It's that you wanted to put them onto a screen that you knew she was going to use and interact with.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I thought that was the real key. And the thing with learning different languages, you wouldn't be able to pick up how to speak English using a book. You have to really hear the language and hear how it's spoken and hear how it's used. So I thought that was very important too, that
right.
She heard someone speaking.
And that is important. But at the same time, you know, I was reading about this and wondering if you really can learn a language this way. I mean, it's something that's far from immersion, right, to just use an app on an iPhone or an iPad. It seems like you could pick up words and phrases for sure. But can you learn a language with an app like this?
Yeah, exactly. And unfortunately, the way that we learn languages is that you have to use it and you have to interact with it. And you have to think about how you're going to answer certain questions. Otherwise, you're just memorizing words and phrases. So the great thing is when she started learning how to say hello and how to say how are you, she had a grandmother there that spoke Ojibwe. And the great thing about that is that, you know, first of all, she knew who she was talking to. She was very comfortable with using Ojibwe words and phrases. And she really started to pick up different words and phrases from her grandmother that weren't in the app.
Oh, so what you're saying is that this kind of started a conversation between your granddaughter
exactly.
and her grandmother, your daughter and her grandmother.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And you know what the great thing is that once you start into conversational use of the language, then you're not that far away from being able to speak it regularly. And I thought that was so cool.
So give us a brief tour, other than the words and phrases in Ojibwe that are included in your app, a brief tour through what else it can do. It displays territorial maps and other part of Ojibwe culture.
Yeah, exactly. And so when you load up the app, of course, you get all the words and phrases, but you also get pictures for kids. So if they want to learn how to write syllabics, which is a writing system that we use in Ojibwe, it's basically a vowel or a sound-based alphabet using ancient style characters. And so you get to see how the Ojibwe word is written, and you get to see a picture there. So kids really like to use that piece of it just to see the pictures. And then you also see the map section. So an important part of your identity is knowing where you come from. So in the map section, the Ojibwe territory actually spans over 3 provinces and into 4 or 5 states. And you get to see, you know, where the Ojibwe is spoken and where the Ojibwe people come from. So that's really cool. And then we also have, of course, the credit section, you know, whose voice are you actually hearing? Mm-hmm. So,
well, it's certainly not a traditional way to learn any culture or language, let alone one that's so old as Ojibwe culture. And I wonder if you've gotten any pushback, Derek Baxter.
Yeah, you know what? Some people have been saying you shouldn't give the app away for free. It's not going to work. Certainly don't give the source code away for free. And that's what we've done. So we've done probably everything opposite of what people have been asking us to do and giving us advice on. So it seems to be working, and you know, people are using the app. In fact, it's loaded to so many iPad carts in the school, and it's actually used as a learning tool for the Ojibwe classroom. And as well, if you don't have an Ojibwe speaker, they use the app to speak Ojibwe in the classroom and play games with the app.
Well, it's the most high-tech and non-traditional way to learn an ancient culture in the tech age. Derek Baxter, president and app developer for Ogoke Learning Systems. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Todd.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. So how do you turn a pie chart or a graph into sound? And really, why would you want to? Well, NASA did. They found that astronauts floating around in space have limited vision and a warped sense of spatial awareness. Visual data, like a graph or a chart, just won't do in a lot of those circumstances. So one solution is something called sonification. It was developed in the 1990s, and sonification uses patterns in sound that can let astronauts determine time and space measurements. There are sonification models of the solar system of individual planets. Maybe not of huge practical use to astronauts yet, but data sonification is now a full-fledged academic field with a growing number of daily uses. John Hockenberry spoke with Brian Fu, who is pushing the boundaries of sonification. He's an application developer for the New York Public Library Labs, and when Fu was faced with the limits of sterile pie charts and graphs, he turned to sound and to music.
I think there's always something missing to, like, say, like a chart or a data visualization. Something like music has inherent ambiguity and emotive quality to it, and it gives you a visceral response.
And it's great with relationships, sound.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you could see where sound is already used, you know, like a Geiger counter or like a heart rate monitor, things that are relatively simple. But
no, people think that Geiger counter sound is radiation.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how powerful it is.
Yeah, so I think it gets tricky when you think about more complex data sets. Like, that's a very simple, single-dimension piece of data. But what was interesting to me in terms of combining data and music is kind of force you to think about what should the listener's visceral reaction be to this data set. Because whether I like it or not, they will get a visceral reaction to music. If you don't get it, just listen to this. So this song is actually kind of a simulation of somebody taking a ride on the 2 train, a train that goes from Brooklyn through Manhattan to the Bronx. The instrumentation that you hear at any given point in the song correlates to the median household income of the neighborhood that you're passing through. So that's actually 2 dimensions, the latitude and longitude. So I needed to move through that data in a very particular way. So I chose the New York City subway, something I think a lot of New Yorkers can connect to. So if the song becomes louder, that means that the neighborhood that you're passing through has a higher median household income. If it's quieter, then it has a lower median household income.
We're in Manhattan right now.
Yeah, yeah. So this point in the song is you are entering Manhattan. You're in Wall Street right now, and it's loud.
Oh, yeah.
It's loud. It's pompous.
Can't afford the rent here.
The median household income is over $200,000. We're moving uptown. I think we're like in Midtown area.
Midtown, okay.
It's still going to sustain its loudness a bit. It's going to taper off as you get closer and closer to Harlem. That's actually where my stop is in 125th Street.
And you didn't write this song. You just inputted the numbers, and the algorithm put the sound together.
Correct. So my creative input is figuring out how to map the data to the sound. So it is the algorithm is my creative contribution to this.
All right, so it's getting really quiet here.
From here on out, it's going to get quieter and quieter, especially when you get all the way up to East Bronx. That's about 15 times less the median household income of the highest point, which is in the financial district. So we're talking a difference between $200,000, over $200,000, to under $15,000. And that's in a span of like 3 miles, which is pretty incredible.
That is amazing.
Yeah.
I have such a clear visual sense of entering the Bronx, and to add this sound to it really enriches it.
Yeah, and I think that's some of the better feedback that I got from this is people who actually take the 2 train, they're like, I know exactly where that stop is. You know, I have like a high school teacher in the Bronx who is telling me that, yeah, I take that train all the time, and I know exactly where in the song, you know, we get off.
Now, why would the New York Public Library be interested in this?
I think in terms of the importance of having open access to information, and in this case, data sets, you know, we need to think about what are the new ways in which people generate knowledge or access information. For me as a creative person, like I want data, I want information, and I want to create new things with that.
Well, let's hear another example here.
Sure.
Feels like I'm in New Orleans, but
yes, that's correct. That's
no kidding.
The Rebirth Brass Band, a well-known band in New Orleans. This song represents coastal regression in Louisiana. So this song is actually kind of slowly drowning, so to speak.
We're listening to sea level rise.
Correct. Sea level rise over a pretty long period of time.
Is loud drowning or is soft drowning? What's the dynamic?
Yeah, so it's less about loud and soft. In this case, I have very particular sound samples that I just slowly stretch out and distort based on how much sea level rise there is. So it's almost thinking about, like, you know, instrumentation, like almost kind of just getting slowly and slowly enveloped with water. I have an impulse to make pretty sounding music, but at the same time, when you're dealing with certain issues, like how should the listener be feeling? Like in this case, like they should probably feel a little uncomfortable about it, or they should feel a little anxious that this is kind of an immediate thing that you should think about. And the other good thing about music is that, you know, it gets stuck in your head. So
that's exactly right. I mean, it's very memorable. What applications are you excited about trying in the future?
I think this data sonification or data songification, what I do, might be appropriate for, again, like kind of real-time data, something that you could kind of just passively listen to. You could maybe think about, like, you know, using very smart devices in the house, so to like kind of listen to your energy usage as you go about your day.
So you come into a room and you can hear by some high-pitched sound or something that who's got all the equipment on? Unplug some stuff. Whereas if it's visual, if you're not looking at it, it's not happening.
Correct. And ideally, I think the creative aspect of it is trying to make it like pleasing. Like you don't want to have this high-pitched thing kind of on all the time. But yeah, kind of like integrating into, you know, something that you'd be actually interested in kind of hearing.
Brian, thanks so much.
Thank you.
John Hockenberry speaking to Brian Fu there, an application developer for the New York Public Library Labs. Well, here's something to take with you today. Did last night's debate change your mind on who you're going to vote for on November 8th?
I am going to be voting third party. I'm a 25-year-old millennial, and I'm also a young farmer, farming with my family. And I was blatantly disrespected by both parties tonight. We failed to bring up any big policy situations that really need to be passed right now. As a young farmer, TPP is imperative to my survival and getting into an industry that is very difficult and very trying.
I don't want people voting for someone who has no respect for women. And the fact that he has no respect for women, that he has been making claims about women and saying things about women that are very rude, is something that is disgusting. And for Donald Trump, if he were to become president, is something that is horrific.
Your reactions to last night's debate and to the election going forward. There's one more debate next Wednesday. We're going to be covering that too along with you. So we want to hear about your choices for this election. Call us at 8778-MYTAKE. You can always leave a comment, of course, at thetakeaway.org. And follow me on Twitter if you want. I'm at Todd Zwillick. Thank you so much for listening. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.